This week on the Best of Flashpoints, Kevin Pina continues his reports from Port-au-Prince as hundreds of thousands of people remain homeless and in critical need of shelter and food as the rainy season approaches Haiti. Also, Joanna Berrigan, a medical aid worker, describes the unraveling humanitarian crisis there. Plus, Andres Tomas Quinteros reports back from months inside the Brazilian embassy in Honduras, where he was stationed with exiled President Manuel Zelaya. We report on a new massive weapons stockpiling agreement between the U.S. and Israel, and Barbara Lubin of the Middle East Children's Alliance talks about the disastrous collusion between the U.S. and the Palestinian Authority as a new wave of internal repression hits the ground in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our drumbeat coverage of the situation on the ground in Port-au-Prince, where the earthquake is still wreaking havoc with everyday life and where tens of thousands of Haitians are facing the rainy season without any food, without any shelter, and the aid program is still not working. Joining us from the ground in Port-au-Prince is our special correspondent, Kevin Pina. Kevin, welcome. Welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hey, Kenneth.
All right. We were talking just before we got you on the line for the recording that you're seeing more and more disease, more and more sickness. Tell us a little bit about what you've seen today.
Well, people are malnourished. I visited a camp today in Cité Militaire, which is an area just outside of Cité Soleil, and probably about 600 families, several thousand people camped out in the grounds of a company called Haitian Tractor. The owner's been gracious enough to let them camp out there, but it's only going to be temporary. But one of the things that's going through those camps is most of the adults have diarrhea now. All of the children have diarrhea and flu. Babies are unable to keep down milk. Mothers were telling me that they were breastfeeding, but their babies were throwing up the milk. You could tell that people were growing more and more destitute in this particular camp. In the meantime, one of the leaders of the camp who works in the committee was complaining about the bureaucracy that they have to go through just in order to receive aid. If there's no non-governmental organization or international group such as the Red Cross or other private group that's working with them, then they have to make their own request to the United Nations. And in order to do that, they have to be officially recognized by the Minister of Social Affairs. Well, luckily, one of their members did have a registry with the Ministry of Social Affairs, but then they had to take a list of every single one of the families. They had to take a list of every single member of the family, so they had to do all of this reporting. Then they have to go down to UN headquarters, and they turn in the papers, and they wait, and they wait, and they wait. And they're not even given a phone number to call them back. They're merely told, just give us your phone number. They won't give them their phone numbers. And they wait. They've been waiting for weeks now for any sort of assistance. The only assistance they've gotten was the Red Cross did come through and put in one of those large container of water, but then they themselves had to buy the materials to treat it, the chlorine to be able to treat it so that people could drink it. It was non-potable water that was left for them. So the situation was growing graver and graver for them, and they're just sort of shrugging their shoulders. You know, we've gone through the hoops. We've made a list of everyone in the camp. We've told them how many children, how many men, how many women, the list of all the families, all of their ages, how many people in their families were killed, how many people in their families were injured during the quake. We turn in the paperwork, and all we've been doing is waiting. And we have no way to contact them. They don't have a car, so it means that they would have to get on a tap-tap and spend 2 hours there, going to UN military headquarters out by the airport, and then 2 hours going back. I offered to take them. They said they were going to wait another couple days, and then they were going to take me up on my offer of a ride. But they're growing increasingly frustrated. But I think that's the same situation throughout all of the camps. Of course, some of them are better than others. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who are sleeping in the dirt right now under terrible conditions, very unsanitary conditions. I mean, but everybody's doing the best they can. But, of course, in those close quarters, Any sort of disease is going to rage through there. I mean, there are growing cases of tuberculosis that are being counted now, growing cases of tetanus, as I said before. Measles are also raging among the children, and particularly when the children are malnourished and they're dehydrated, it's going, you know, there's a possibility of death due to what are obviously preventable diseases.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Kevin Pina. He is our special correspondent for Flashpoints on the ground in Port-au-Prince. Kevin has been covering one tragedy after another in Haiti for the last 20 years and has been there now for some time after the earthquake, trying to monitor the situation on the ground. And, I know, Kevin, you spoke with some families in Cité Soleil today, and there were some interesting stories that, I guess, in a way you could say, paint the U.S. military in a bit of a different light.
Yeah, no, I was very surprised to hear that there are actually growing confrontations between U.S. military forces and the Brazilian peacekeeping forces and the Jordanian forces in Cité Soleil in particular. I think that the U.S. military is witnessing what the community has long since claimed, which is those forces have been mistreating them and abusing them. They relayed to me several interesting stories. One was there was a food line where there was a woman who one of the Jordanian soldiers kicked her in the face, and there were two U.S. Marines who were standing by. The witnesses to this said that they grabbed that Jordanian, drug him from the truck, threw him on the ground at gunpoint until the Jordanian commander came, and then apparently another UN Brazilian commander came, but they took that soldier out of the field at the request of the United States Marines. That was one incident that was relayed to me. A second involved a Brazilian soldier who apparently slapped a man, it wasn't clear exactly why he had slapped him. It seemed to the U.S. soldiers out of the blue, the way that he was described to me, but again, the U.S. military soldiers took that Brazilian officer and threw him on the ground at gunpoint until he was removed from the field. So I think that the U.S. military, particularly the grunts on the ground, are beginning to see firsthand that what the people of Cité Soleil have been describing, which is patterns of abuse meted out upon them by Brazilian peacekeeping forces and Jordanian peacekeeping forces in particular, they're seeing this for the first time, and apparently they're intervening.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Kevin, talk a little bit about, have you seen any more action taken by the Haitian government? Is there any more information about the movement of more supplies out to where they need to be? Are we still talking about a million people without shelter?
Certainly, and remember, it's not just in the capital, it's throughout the countryside as well. I mean, there have been, you know, probably tens of thousands of people who have left the capital to go out in the countryside, and of course, the countryside's been neglected for so long, there's really no infrastructure to take care of them. They're out there, and God knows what's going to happen to them. There are no schools, no hospitals, no real care. But at least they don't have the fear of disease, mounting disease that's happening in these makeshift camps throughout the capital. It's not really clear what the government's plan is for this. I'm hearing a lot of posturing on TV. They seem to be making all those noises that bureaucrats make when they talk about being in control. President Pabal earlier this week finally addressed the nation in a national address. But as far as any real substantive plan, as far as what they're going to do with all of these people, how they're going to stop the diseases from spreading, how they're going to deal with more permanent shelters when the rainy season comes, there doesn't seem to be any answers in the offing.
Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, are they on the ground out there, sleeves rolled up, digging in?
You know, I don't hang out in those circles. I understand that they're around, but I really don't know, other than photo opportunities and cheerleading. I'm not sure exactly what they're doing. God, I would love to see them out there digging a few latrine trenches to help people with sanitation. I'd certainly love to see them out there passing out prenatal vitamins for pregnant women and vitamins for children who are suffering so desperately in this crisis. I'd love to see them out there handing out sacks of rice. course, raising money is important too, but as I reported, I believe it was last night, you know, of the more than $500 million that's been requested for this crisis by the United Nations and the international community, they've already met their goal. Now, what's happening with that money and where the aid is and why it isn't being distributed in a more responsive manner is baffling to not only me, but I think is frustrating to the Haitians who are living under these conditions. Today, I heard for the first time, people were talking very angrily and saying, we're not going to take it very shortly. We're going to take to the streets en masse. And I heard that in several camps today where they were saying, it's just a matter of time where we're just not going to take it anymore. We're going to take to the streets. And when that happens, I shudder to think what potential outbreaks of violence might occur if there are miscommunications between the Marines, if they don't understand Haitian culture, how the UN will react, if tens of thousands of these people take to the streets to protest these utterly abhorrent conditions. I simply don't know what will happen.
All right, Kevin Pina speaking to us on the ground in Port-au-Prince, a very fine reporter and filmmaker, award-winning reporter, and his film is called Haiti, We Must Kill the Bandits, an extraordinary documentary about the violence and the mass murder committed by the United Nations who came in after the U.S. kidnapped Aristide, and the United Nations became the enforcers of that policy. And we're hearing more about that from Kevin today. Amazing in which the U.S. troops are having to restrain these so-called peacekeepers. You can check Kevin's work out at HaitiAction.net. He also works with the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund. You can there's a click on there for HaitiAction.net. And Kevin Pina, before we let you go, I just want to make sure... How's your family doing, your relatives, and are you safe now? Any more death threats?
I seem to be okay. I haven't let a lot of people know where I'm at these days. I'm laying low, except when I go out during the day to the camps, but I'm always moving, taking assessments, shooting what footage I can, taking interviews I can, distributing what money, what food for the Haiti Emergency Relief, working on logistics for their relief program. You know, I'm taking it day by day. Right now, I'm having the problem that everybody else is having. You know, they say there are all these tents in town, but I can't find a tent for my family. I've got 17 people who are, you know, sort of sleeping under the stars right now, and I'm desperately seeking tents for them. If I have to, I'm going to have to break out of my own pocket and pay for it, despite the fact that they've said that there's all this money that's been raised, there are all these tents that have been sent here, but nobody's really seeing them. I've asked several places. I simply cannot find tents.
Kevin Pina on the ground in Port-au-Prince. Be careful. Of course, we will check in with you tomorrow. We and the audience of Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio appreciate the kind of reporting and the kind of information that you bring us and the risk you take to do it. Again, be careful. We talk to you soon, Kevin.
Thank you, Dennis.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're now joined by Joanna Berrick, and she's a nurse. She returned from Haiti last week, treating people, went down with the bishop, the local bishop from Philadelphia, Gumbleton, and were spending a lot of time trying to save lives. She works with the House of Grace Catholic Worker, and she's been keeping in daily touch since she got home. Welcome, Joanna Berrick.
Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Tell us about what it was like to go down there. What did you do? What was your experience like? Give us an idea of what it looked like for you.
Well, I went with, as you said, Bishop Gumbleton. He's actually from Detroit, Michigan, but also part of our team was a doctor and two nurse practitioners, Miriam Ford, Colleen Kelly, and Susan Rice. And we already have an established relationship with a group it's called T-Plaz Kazo, and they are a group of women who are being trained as community health outreach workers. And so we went to meet with them and have them lead us and tell us what they needed from us. And so their concern was to have us go into the communities where they knew no other health care providers had been. And so we went to a neighborhood very close, or actually part of Tiplaz Cazo, called Caradur, and literally set up a tent and made like a little makeshift tent clinic with sheets to provide privacy, and spent hours just with people lining up, many of whom hadn't been seen since the earthquake, a few serious cases, a lot of trauma, tons of people suffering what I can only call psychosomatic effects of this terrible trauma, and loss, dealing and talking with people over the loss of their homes, the loss of their children. And then, and I think this is a point not for any of us to lose sight of, the many, many people who never had access to a healthcare provider before the earthquake because of the desperate poverty and the situation in Haiti. So we saw many people who kind of took advantage of the fact that there were healthcare providers there in their community.
It took a 7.0 magnitude earthquake to get some medical attention.
This is the way you can look at it. And you know, not to be glib and not to exaggerate, but so many people were living in earthquake conditions in many ways before it ever hit this community. And I know I listened in with Kevin's report. If you've ever been to Cité Soleil and seen that, people do not have clean water. There's no electricity. I was just there last week visiting with a friend of mine who's running a soccer club trying to have a positive impact on the children that live there. And the whole time he's talking, I'm aware of this feces-ridden water draining in front of his clubhouse, just inhuman conditions. That's the way it was before the earthquake. So you can imagine what's going to happen now in these communities.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, the rain began to fall in earnest in Haiti, and this morning there was outrage, fear, disgust, as Haitians in the street, left without anything, any roof over their head, without food, took to the streets wondering what's happening, where is the government. There to cover the protest on the ground is our own Kevin Pina, our special correspondent. Kevin, talk a little bit about what happened in terms of the rain and then the response to the rain.
Well, the guy here at the hotel where I'm staying told me. He said it was going to rain. I didn't believe him. I made a bet with him. But obviously I was wrong and he was right. He knows his country better than I. And the rain did indeed start pouring at about 4:30 a.m. this morning. And when it did start to pour, you could tell because you could hear the wails. They rose throughout the capital. You could hear people screaming, wailing in the streets. As the rain began to fall, it was unbelievable the noise that you could hear rising up throughout the streets of Port-au-Prince. Even where I'm staying, it was palpable. You could hear it. From then on, I started receiving call after call from various contacts in different camps throughout the capital, where they were telling me that they were in danger, that they're in mud, that there is no proper sanitation, that suddenly there were feces and places where they were taking care of their bodily functions were suddenly overflowing into where they were sleeping. They were worried about the children especially. I did my best to try to go out to try to help particularly the most sick children. I used money from the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund in order to help those people immediately as soon as the rain started to fall.
Now, you're talking about wailing and screaming. You're talking about hundreds and thousands of people who were caught without anything to defend themselves against the rain. And so that they began to...
It was a collective wail. Dennis, it was a collective wail I cannot describe. You could hear it throughout the capital as the rain began to fall.
All right. So the rain did fall. Talk a little bit more about the response to the rain in terms of what happened to the people and what their response was to the lack of any activity by the government.
Well, people, of course, have no proper shelter. They have no proper sanitation. Most of them are still very hungry and very thirsty. They have not received aid. The distribution of aid in this country has been paltry and absolutely scandalous to this point, whether it be through the Pavel administration or whether it be through the United Nations or private agencies who I know, of course, have been working very hard, but it just has not been enough. It's too little, too late. And today what we feared worse began to happen, which was when the rain fell, people who were basically living under sheets in the capital, everything they owned, which is very little, of course, because they lost most of everything in the earthquake, was wet. And children and adults and the elderly, of course, who were the most vulnerable, particularly the children and the elderly, we can only expect that this is only going to exacerbate what was already a difficult medical situation in those camps. We know that there were already diseases raging through those camps, preventable diseases, and it's only going to increase, particularly since the sanitation issue is so crucial. People don't have proper sanitation. I went down after the flooding today, and I literally saw children who were sleeping near pools of water where there were feces floating nearby. It's untenable. It's just not acceptable. So what were cries of anguish, what were cries of misery, suddenly turned into anger. And spontaneously, demonstrations began to break out. They started in Shamars in front of the presidential palace. People started marching. 100 turned to 200, 200 turned to 300, and exponentially eventually evolved into thousands in the streets shouting invectives against President Pabal, shouting invectives against the United Nations mission, calling for the return of Aristide. There was a popular chant in the middle of those demonstrations today which said, if Aristide were here, he'd be soaked with us as well, meaning that they feel as if he would be in more solidarity with them than the current relief efforts that have happened thus far.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with our special correspondent, Kevin Pina, on the ground in Port-au-Prince, in and around Port-au-Prince, where tens of thousands of people are living in makeshift camps, many living without any shelter, as you hear Kevin describing. Many children, many young people who have been wounded or suffering from malnutrition are now being exposed to the elements in very dangerous ways that will obviously lead to a series of pandemics and deaths that could be prevented. But now it seems that this is going to the next level. So you're saying, Kevin, that people are now becoming angry. Have there been direct confrontations with the Haitian police, with the UN troops? Where are these 20,000 U.S. soldiers now?
Well, it was interesting. As this demonstration, the largest of them, which I followed, began to snake through the streets of the capital. And by the way, I want to revise my estimates. We're no longer talking about tens of thousands homeless here. We're now talking about hundreds of thousands homeless. Now that I've gotten a better vantage point and have done more, gotten more out there in the field, hundreds of thousands of people are homeless in this capital. When they finally decided where they were going to go, which is to the United Nations headquarters, which is where the nexus, if you will, the command center of the relief efforts is housed, they began snaking through the roads of Port-au-Prince. They began going towards the Toussaint Louverture Airport, which is controlled, of course, by the United States military. Finally, when they were just before the headquarters of the United Nations, a phalanx of Haitian police officers, riot police officers with shields and tear gas showed up to block them in the road. When they approached, the Haitian police were very hostile. The protesters demanded to pass through. The Haitian police then reacted toward them. They pushed several of them into a canal. Several people were injured. They began to spray tear gas. And the crowd then, of course, I have to give them credit. Crowd did not react. They were very peaceful. They backed off despite the provocations of the Haitian National Police. And then they then went back and they began to block the road to the airport with rocks, whatever they could find. And they snarled traffic here today in the capital near the airport for 4 hours.
Again, listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're hearing about a confrontation taking place now on the ground in Port-au-Prince by very frustrated, very troubled, a very endangered people being abandoned, really, in front of the world. We keep hearing about aid. We keep hearing about the most extraordinary outpouring of love and aid to the people of Haiti. And here they are in the streets on the first day of a serious rainstorm, and the tragedy is going to unfold. Now, if nothing gives here, Kevin, what happens next? It really seems like we're on the verge of an unbelievable response by hundreds of thousands of people who are now desperate and don't know where to go.
We're absolutely right. These demonstrations are only going to increase if this continues this way. And, of course, that's what the U.S. Marines are here for. Now, I know that some people might have been taken a little bit aback by my reporting last night, where I reported that the U.S. Marines have actually intervened when they've seen abuse committed by the Brazilians and by the Jordanians in Cité Soleil. But that would be a simplistic rendering of what I was actually saying. It doesn't mean that they're not actually going to take their position against demonstrators in the streets here if it's called for to keep the Vival government in power. What I was merely saying was that this abuse had been meted out so long by the Brazilians and the Jordanians against the people of Cité Soleil that even the U.S. military troops could see it for what it was. However, what I also have to say is that Cité Soleil today was also paralyzed. People, as there were demonstrations that were sneaking towards the airport that blocked and snarled traffic to the UN military command headquarters, to the Toussaint Louverture airport, which is controlled by the U.S. military, the people of Cité Soleil were burning tires in the middle of the street. They also paralyzed that community as well today. So there were literally thousands of people in the streets today demanding that they get tents, shelter, food, water, and medicines, and also very clearly demanding that Aristide, former President Aristide, who was ousted in a coup in February 2004, be allowed to return, because they believe that if he were involved in these relief efforts, it would not happen this way, that he would be there in the streets with them. They really feel that solidarity strongly. You could sense that. It was in all of their chants today in the streets of Port-au-Prince.
And of course, Kevin, as you've made in interviews past, the point is not just a spiritual thing, that there's a close working relationship, but that they have, through Lavalas, set up infrastructures for community organization. That Aristide, one of the things that he has been known for is helping to organize so that real change can happen inside Haiti. So there are pre-existing networks we're talking about, right, in which a system of help and aid could unfold.
No, absolutely. And that's exactly what the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund has been trying to utilize in order to get aid to the most vulnerable on the ground here, particularly pregnant women with children and the elderly and small children in these camps. Of course, the United Nations and the international community have not taken advantage of that. Quite the opposite. They're afraid of them. I think that that's part of what erupted on the streets today, when you saw these masses of poor suddenly, because of this rainfall and this panic, realizing that they're so vulnerable themselves, that their lives are literally hanging by a thread, with the threat of diseases raging through those camps. You saw quite clearly that their reaction represented that same level of organization. Those committees exist. They are in the camps. The international community has not taken advantage of them. The United Nations has not making any entrees to those people or those groups whatsoever. Instead, they have treated them with abject fear and isolation.
Kevin, I'm looking at some of the photographs that you put up as a part of the Haiti Information Project at HaitiAction.net. I'm looking at, I guess, these are photographs of the protest today. It does look like there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are joining this protest, and I guess they're marching towards the U.S. military?
No, they're marching past the U.S. military, actually. There were a couple Marines who were caught in the crowd who got out of their car and sort of stood there shaking their heads because they'd never seen anything like this before. They'd never seen the popular masses of Haiti actually redress their concerns the way that they did today, spontaneously. It was very interesting to see their reaction. It was good, actually, in some ways, to see that they didn't draw their guns, but rather they came out of their car and they just watched. There were two African-American Marines who didn't speak Creole who were caught in the middle of a crowd. They needed to get their car through because they had someone who was ill in it. I had to do negotiations. I had to do translation today for them, but they were absolutely lost. They did not know what to do, so I helped them today to get this person to the hospital who was in their car. But they just had no sense, no clue of who the Haitian people were. They had no clue of who La Valas was. I had to tell them, these people are asking for tents. These people are asking for shelter. These people are asking for food. These people are asking for water. As they looked at me rather strangely, wondering, well, where is it? I think they themselves don't really know. The U.S. Marines who are on the ground, the grunts, don't really know what's going on. That people are suffering to the level of misery that they're forced to suffer today.
All right. Kevin Pina on the ground in Port-au-Prince talking to us about the ongoing second wave of death. And I just want to follow up on something you said. You've been fairly cautious in all your estimates all the way through. And you were saying until last night, tens of thousands of homeless without shelter or food or necessary medical care. Now, in today's interview, Kevin, you've upped that to hundreds of thousands. What are the kinds of things that you've seen around that have you convinced that we're now talking about hundreds of thousands of Haitians on the run?
Well, I've been taken to several more communities over the last week throughout the capital, and I've been trying to do a tally as best I can. And what seemed like tens of thousands now, in my mind, is quite clearly hundreds of thousands. There are communities of 20,000 here, 20,000 there, 10,000 here, 9,000 there, 6,000 here. But we're talking about literally dozens and dozens of communities with those numbers of populations in them. I've got a better idea now, and it has to be hundreds of thousands of people here who are homeless, who are facing this situation in the capital.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. For about four months, our next guest was holed up inside the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, with exiled President Manuel Zelaya. Reporter and human rights activist Andres Canteras made a decision to cover the story of the Honduran coup from the inside out. You heard him on Democracy Now! And Flashpoints and other outlets reporting about the situation inside with the president, the various levels of attacks by the coup government, and the renegade military of Honduras, and you heard about the resistance to the coup. We also learned in heartbreaking detail how the United States, under its new first-ever African-American president, was going to abandon democracy and stand with the coup leaders against the people. Joining us to talk about what happened, its significance, and its implications is Andres Thomas Canteras. Welcome into the studio. We talked to you many days through the magic of microphones, so thank you for coming in back in the Bay Area.
Such a pleasure to be here, Dennis, especially after all the months of talking with you on the cell phone in that embassy, and now to see you here and to be in the studio and to be this close to the listeners. It just means a lot to me.
Well, the work was much appreciated. We heard from many different people who want to know a different perspective than what's coming through the mainstream, and you just did a great job. Let's just talk about the overview and the overview in terms of my lead in the context of, we were talking before we went on the air, of still having hope. Mm-hmm. We had a new president.
Right.
There was a coup. It was clear. Yeah. He was taken out in gunpoint. We're thinking maybe this new president, in love with democracy, wouldn't be enforcing the Monroe Doctrine, but It was a heartbreak.
It has been a heartbreak. And that heartbreak was very much expressed on January 27th. That Wednesday was, of course, a day of deep remorse, deep sadness. Why? Because President Zelaya was leaving the country. But it's really important to point out what we need to celebrate. And the people of Honduras, on that very day, where did they go? They did not go to the stadium where the inauguration was taking place of Porfirio Lobo. In fact, it was incredible that there were so many empty seats in the stadium. And that day, the inauguration day, was made for Porfirio Lobo. And yet, where were the people? The estimates are of over 250,000 people in the streets marching. And they were headed where? Toward the airport to say goodbye, to bid farewell to their president, who they had accompanied all of the months that he was in the embassy. And they wanted to be there near him on the very day that he was leaving. So basically, it really was a bittersweet day. It was a day of fullness, both joy that he was out, that all of us were liberated from captivity, but also deep sadness because, one, he was leaving the country, but two, we're ending up with Pepe Lobo, who is continuing the policies that gave rise to the resistance.
All right, let's just hearken back to the beginning of the coup and remind people, because it's not, you know, history, time, distance, confusion, other big stories. People forget what the details were, but there's nothing confusing about what happened in Honduras. There was a subversion of democracy, an illegal coup, and a president was taken out on gunpoint,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. It that is what happened. There are many questions as to why, and there are many answers to that. One of which I'd like to tell, I learned on New Year's Eve, because that night, just a little over a month ago, President Zelaya told the story of how exactly 1 year earlier, the new minimum wage was going to take effect. And he ended up telling the story about how that happened. He basically went to his advisors and said, you know, look to when is it that the last time a minimum wage was really passed and took effect, and compare that to all the time that has passed since, and what is it that the minimum wage should be raised to now so that there could be fairness and that the workers could get a living wage. Well, basically they told him, yes, you should raise it. However, you should raise it just 5%, because that's all that the elite powers in the country could take. But if you want us to do as you say, then the minimum wage should be raised by 60%. And he thought about it for a minute and he said, raise it 60%. He didn't even want to budge. He wanted fairness, he wanted justice, and his policies were about making that happen. And they said, if you raise it by 60, they will kick you out, they will remove you from power. And he said, raise it by 60, and he did, and it was passed, and of course months later they removed him.
Well, we think it's the sort of the disinformation in the mainstream is that he wanted to have a quick referendum so that he could keep himself in power for a longer period of time.
Exactly. That's the
total confusion about that, right?
Standard line of the dominant
media.
And
what was the situation?
They kept repeating it. You know, if you repeat a lie often enough, people believe it. And what was the situation? It was impossible. And the dominant media knew this, as did the right wing in Honduras and elsewhere, that there was no way that the president could extend his time in office, even if he wanted to. So he didn't want to, for one, but what he did want to do is fulfill his promises, which began on day one when he was president. What happened on that day? He pushed forward in 2006 as his first legislative impulse to pass a law which has to do with citizen participation. He was interested in a citizenry that is participatory. And so the culmination of this was to have a referendum, which was a non-binding straw poll, to ask if they want a new constitution. So and for that, he is basically criminalized. I mean, they accuse him of doing exactly what you're saying, and the dominant media repeats it. But that's not what it was about. It was about the president wanting to empower the people, and that was the high crime he committed.
And democratize,
yes,
the Constitution, the system. Now, back to the minimum wage.
Right.
Now, of course, that's the most believable. That's what makes the powers that be nervous everywhere. That's what unites the United States and, you know, the sort of slave wage economy they want to recreate in Haiti, and what's going on here in Honduras, which was, now we have to say, Obama, you know, he supported the coup, but Clinton's modus operandi was not about democracy. It was about free trade. This was an economic policy. Hillary Clinton had no concern for human rights here. Mm-hmm. That did not guide this policy.
It did not. And that's clearly shown by the statements that came from the Obama administration. Who were the ones who were the targets of the harshest accusations and name-calling of the Obama administration? Did they condemn the human rights violators? They did not. What were the strongest? Who were the strongest terms reserved for? President Zelaya. Hillary Clinton called him reckless for trying to return to his own country. This guy, Louis Amselem, from the Organization of American States, the U.S. representative there, he called President Zelaya foolish and irresponsible after he returned to the embassy. And now, were any of those kind of terms used against the perpetrators of torture, disappearance, murder, political assassination? Nothing can be found in any statements by the Obama administration or the U.S. embassy in any strong way talking about those heinous crimes against the people.
How many, can we just sort of estimate how many people were killed, were kidnapped? What does that look like?
Basically, the amount of the numbers killed are well over 120. There were over 4,000 human rights violations documented against people themselves. We're talking about illegal imprisonment. We're talking about over 100 political prisoners that have long-term political accusations for their involvement, and you know, hundreds and hundreds hospitalized for the beatings that they endured. So, and this, you know, I'm recalling a statement that the president made at the end of the year with these figures. Mm-hmm.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're talking about the recent coup in Honduras. We're talking with Andres Contreras. He was inside that Brazilian embassy in Honduras with exiled President Manuel Zelaya. And it was not a good moment for the hemisphere, for democracy, for the people. I guess before we have to let you go, I want to talk to you a little bit about your decision to stay in there, why it was important to you, and what you think the significance is of what happened. Clearly, it's a negative message from the U.S. government to those who think that, you know, maybe the people should have some sway.
Right.
Look what happened to President Zelaya.
Exactly. You know, Dennis, I had to make a decision every single day as to whether I would stay. And yes, I mean, it was the pressures that we were under were pretty intense, and it was a conscious decision to stay. I had the choice to leave. There were over 300 of us at the beginning. There were less than 10 at the end.
Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Two people in the studio, Barbara Lubin and Nora Barris-Friedman. We're going to be talking back about Palestine. Nora's actually on her way in a couple of weeks to the West Bank. She's got a new article, senior producer of the show, new article about a massive weapons stockpiling agreement that has been signed between the U.S. and Israel. It's pretty extraordinary. According to the article, the Obama administration is planning to store $800 million worth of military equipment, arsenal, and ammunition on Israeli soil, with the caveat that Israel can access the stockpile if it declares a military emergency with U.S. approval. It is, when we talk about arms control in the region, it is bizarre and absurd. Nora, give us the thumbnail sketch. This is on Truth Out today.
Yeah, and the story actually came out about a month ago in Defense News Weekly. And
the trade publication.
Exactly. And then was kind of more publicized when Haaretz, the Israeli daily newspaper, picked it up. And so I was shocked, as we all were, by, you know, just even the figures that we were looking at. $800 million worth of weapons on Israeli soil from U.S. weapons contractors. And the fact that this deal had actually been planned to just be $400 million worth. The fact that the Obama administration had in December organized itself to exactly double that to meet what it called Israel's security needs. Israel had been complaining since the summer of 2006 that its weapons cache was at what they called dangerously low levels after the bombing of Lebanon that killed so many people. And of course, after the bombings of Gaza last year. And I mean, that's just an absurd notion in itself that Israel could claim that it has dangerously low weapons stock and that the United States would rush to alleviate Israel's lack of weapons is also...
And on the heels, let's not forget, of the Gaza slaughter.
Right.
You know, 1,400 people killed and all that other stuff.
As Israel is being scrutinized by international legal bodies, as its officials, including Zippy Livni, of course, the former foreign minister who organized, coordinated, and ordered the attacks on Gaza, was prevented from entering the UK because a judge had issued an arrest warrant for war crimes for her involvement. So this is all happening. You know, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is growing and is making Israel very worried. And instead of, you know, acquiesce to international law and allow inspectors and investigators to come in and really investigate what Israel has done, they run to the Obama administration. The Obama administration signs this $800 million deal over and above the $3.1 billion that they just gave over in guaranteed loans, which has been in place for decades. And on top of that, a new $2.775 billion check was signed by the Obama administration to Israel in December as part of the 10-year, $30 billion kind of military aid bonus plan for Israel. So all of this is happening, and people in the region now are being faced with this threat, where now there are American weapons on Israeli soil, $800 million worth of them, on top of whatever else is already there, that can be used at Israel's discretion if it declares what it defines as a military emergency. They won't tell anybody
the definition. But it's a U.S. weapons stockpile.
Absolutely.
It's a U.S. weapons stockpile. So the U.S. can what? They can come there anytime they want, and we need all our weapons. We're having a war right now.
Right. Well, this is the definition. They call it a forward basing program. They have one in South Korea as well, and other places around the globe, where you know the U.S. Maybe it has its sights on Syria or Iran or who knows where in that region. They could use Israel as the base for their operations. And this is not a new fact. I mean, we've seen this over and over again. Right. But it really solidifies this notion of Israel as a client state and, you know, a nuclear rogue state.
apartheid state at that. And the fact that the Obama administration is continuing to roll over these massive budgets allocated to its war arsenal for Israel is just egregious, especially at this time when schools and healthcare is suffering so much.
All right, Nora Barros Friedman, you should check out the article. It's on truthout.org, put up, I guess it was released today.
Today.
Very good article, important article, and it's really the twilight zone on the heels of the Gaza slaughter, and the beat goes on there. Thanks, Nora.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. People should really check that out. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and continuing the theme of occupied Palestine, but sort of changing the focus a little bit, Barbara Lubin, founder of the Middle East Children's Alliance, a good friend of mine in this show. And last we spoke, you had just been off to Cairo and all that battle. But the work of the Middle East Children's Alliance continues over a long period of time, and there's some important projects that continue that we didn't talk much about because we were focused on all that other stuff. So, like, talk about water.
Well, I will, but I have to say a couple words about Nora's report. I think it was great. I think it's really, that article is very important. And thank you for your work on Palestine, Nora. It really is very helpful for the rest of us who do work and have done this kind of work. And I think we also have to, when we talk about the United States and militarizing and giving weapons and all the rest of it, we cannot forget this wall that is being dug in Egypt on the border of Rafah, which is going to cut off all of the tunnels that have been the lifeline for at least the last 4 or 5 years for the people in Gaza. And it's pretty frightening. And that wall is being financed also by the United States. And the other piece I have to say is that, you know, I just recently returned from the West Bank. I was in Cairo for many weeks, but then decided to go to the West Bank. And what was most shocking to me was the fact that the Palestinian Authority police have now been trained. They've been taken into Jordan and trained by the Americans, and in particular, a man named Dayton. He has taken them into Jordan, and he has trained them to behave exactly like the Israeli military has behaved towards the Palestinians. So it was surreal to be in Dahesha refugee camps and to not hear anybody talking about the Israeli occupation at all, and you don't see the Israelis. But now it's the Palestinian Authority, and it's the Palestinians against the Palestinian Authority. And the Israelis are brilliant in the way they play this. It's shocking, but it's brilliant. But I also want to say that within the last 2 days, the Israelis have moved back into the Bethlehem area and have taken over the top of a mountain right outside of the Christian town of Beit Sahor, which is where they have built this mammoth settlement. And I remember when Robbie Osman and I, many years ago, heard about the fact that the Israelis were going to move in there and build this settlement, that we got on a plane right away and went over there and stayed out on that mountain with those bulldozers and a handful of wonderful Palestinians and hundreds of Israeli police surrounding us. And we slept there and stayed there for about 2 weeks. Of course, obviously, we didn't stop it. But it's unbelievable the most important thing that people have to remember and know is that the land, every single minute of the day and night, Israel is taking land from Palestine.
And they're going crazy in East Jerusalem.
And the community, the peace community and the activist community, and many of whom are the best, wonderful, are all directed towards Gaza and the occupation of Gaza and what happened in Gaza, which is mammoth. It's grotesque. It's horrible. But in the meantime, all eyes are off what's happening in the West Bank, and it's very dangerous, and it's just what Israel wants. But while our eyes are off the West Bank, Israel is planning to demolish 200 houses in Jerusalem in the Silwan area. This is shocking. These people have lived in Jerusalem forever, and now it's becoming completely filled with Jewish Israeli people. So we have to look at what's happened in Gaza, what's probably going to happen to Gaza again, but never lose sight of the fact that this is a much larger issue than Gaza.
All right. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, that's Barbara Lubin. She's the founder of the Middle East Children's Alliance. They have been engaged in many important life and death and deep projects with the people of occupied Palestine. We just have a couple of minutes, Barbara. So
yes.
Tell us very briefly about a couple of the projects and some of the important events that are coming up for people who are in the Bay Area.
I will. I know I was supposed to talk about Mecca projects, but I'll make you drag me in here again to do that, Dennis.
I will. Open door all the time.
I just couldn't let that go because I'm so enraged about what's happening. I want to let everybody out there know that on Sunday, February 28th at 7 p.m., Ali Abunima, who is the founder of the Electronic Intifada, who has written a wonderful book called One Country, is going to be speaking. And Ali was in Cairo for 2-3 weeks with the Gaza Freedom March that I was involved with. And he's an eloquent speaker.
Articulate, and eloquent.
And
one of the
and
most
right
profound.
On. Yeah. Fabulous. So I want people to please come to Martin Luther King Jr. Middle School. That's at 1781 Rose Street in Berkeley on Sunday, February 28th at 7 o'clock. And then I just quickly want to talk about the Christiansons, that people have Bill and Kathleen Christiansen, who people have heard many times on this very show on Flashpoints. These are former CIA agents who also are eloquent speakers about what is happening to Palestinians and what Israel is doing. And they will be here for the Seville Conference in Marin County on the 4th and 5th of March. And they're going to come to Berkeley and do an event at the Unitarian Fellowship at Cedar and Bonita at 7:30 p.m. That's a Monday, March 8th. Kathleen and Bill Christiansen. Come to both of these events. It's information you need to hear.
And if you're listening in Tennessee or Idaho, I promise we'll play you nice, long excerpts of these extraordinary events. And that
yes.
is the magic and the beauty of community radio and Pacifica Radio. Barbara Lubin, as always, we very much appreciate the work and the courage and the information. And, Palestine is, again, sort of one of those linchpin issues that needs to be dealt with if there is ever going to be peace in this
world.
Yes, yes. Thank you
Thank
both.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank
Nora,
you, Nora.
Barbara, and you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.